work all night and I drink a rum.
Daylight come and we want home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and we want home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and we want home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson and today we're going to be talking about Tim Burton's 1988 film Beetlejuice. Joining me today is my regular co-host Tyler. How's it going, sir?
What's going on, Ben? Feels like it's been a long time.
It's just been, I think, 1 week and a day, right? Since our...
Oh, wow. That's really caught me off guard.
Okay, yeah, it's President's Day. Happy President's Day to you, Tyler.
Yes, Presidents of the United States Day.
Indeed.
Are we honoring just U.S. presidents or all presidents from every country?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I think it's just U.S., probably. Okay. My jingoism tells me so. With us today is the co-founder of a very cool movie blog called The Film Stage, Dan Mecca. Thanks for joining us on the Not Just a Movies podcast.
It is my absolute pleasure to be here. Good sirs.
Indeed. All right, man. Well, if you guys are just joining us for the first time, we start every episode with the character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish up with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So, Tyler, you have the character name game this week.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Okay. It's kind of a deep one, I'm not going to lie.
Okay. Well, why don't you explain the rules to Dan, because he's never played before.
Okay.
Yeah, hit me with it. Let's do this.
At the beginning of the episode, we give you the name of a character. And at the end of the episode, you guess which movie that character's from.
Okay.
Now, generally, there's a one, like, what is it called? Like, one degree. Step,
one degree
from a movie that came out this weekend.
Okay.
So there's some connection, but I actually went 2 degrees.
No.
So you did not.
Keep that in mind. I think the max is 6, Ben. I'm going to go to the judges here.
I'm not going to speculate on what the
max judges are saying. 6.
So hang on, question. When you say this weekend, you mean like this past Friday?
Yeah,
right?
This past Friday. Yes, yes.
Copy that.
So you guys ready?
Yeah, go for it.
All right, so the character for this week is Wade Garrett.
Wade Garrett.
Wade Garrett.
All right, so we'll come back and guess that at the very end of the episode. In the meantime, let's move into the media consume section. This is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching, any sort of cool events we've been to recently, or, I don't know, comic books, concerts, anything like that. So, Tyler, we generally start with you. Let's keep that going. What have you been consuming this week?
Yeah, I actually went to a concert this week.
Did you really?
Yeah, I went to 2.
Wow, that's rare. Okay.
This week, I went and saw Southside Johnny, a blues kind of musician, harmonica playing badass.
Okay.
He usually has a really big band behind him, like big band in the sense of like trumpets and trombones, and saxophones, and piano. The guys from Conan's band, a couple of them were actually in his band for a while before they started playing with Max Weinberg on the Conan, the early Conan show, and they're still around today. Mm-hmm. But
like La Bamba and all them?
Yeah, La Bamba was in it. He was one of the original band. And so he moved from Southside Johnny's band to Conan's band in the 90s. But they still work together. They're still friends. But this was kind of the new incarnation, but Southside Johnny's still around after all these years, and he still puts on a good show. It was really like very intimate. Like it wasn't like at House of Blues where you stand kind of far away. Like it was close. Like he was right there, and he was like walking through the crowd and stuff. And it was at a really obscure location. So, but I had a pretty good time. And although he didn't come out and sign anything, like, you know, I feel like we're personal friends now because I saw him live in concert.
Right.
A confidant. speaking of personal friends, I went and saw Boys to Men in concert.
No way.
No, you did not.
Yeah, I did.
Was it the best show you've ever scene?
No, actually. They have some pretty sappy songs that I'm just not into. But Motown Philly, they still rock it out, and they were doing the dance moves. And although they were huffing and puffing at the end of it, because, you know, they're probably like 40s or 50s by now. Because
they're now men to men. They're men to men.
Yeah, they're men to old guys. or as we were calling it, like men to dust or something like that. I can't remember. Well, yeah, pretty. They really love their fans. They like thanked the fans. I'm not going to consider myself a fan, but I was present.
Mm-hmm.
They thank their fans almost after every song. They're like, you know what, guys, we're still here because you want us to be here and you support us, and go to boys2men.com and see when we're back here in Florida and all this stuff. So yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Okay,
that is awesome.
And then a movie I watched. Well, it wasn't a movie. It was a comedy show. The Comedians of Comedy, live at the El Rey.
Yeah, that's very funny. Did you like it?
Yeah, it was on Instant Watch, and it was only like an hour, and it was like Patton Oswalt, Brian Posehn, Maria Bamford, some of these people that are kind of popular in podcast world now, you know, or originally, or still are, stand-up comedians, mm-hmm. and pretty funny. So,
Maria Bamford doesn't get enough credit, you know?
Is hilarious.
Yeah, I know. Like, she never really broke out of the stand-up thing, but she's so funny.
And I think this one's from like 2004, because they were talking about Carrie Bush, and like she was hilarious there. And then I've heard her on podcasts like within the last year, and she's still hilarious. So yeah, she's definitely underrated.
And did you see that on Netflix Instant?
Yeah, Comedians of Comedy. It's a Patton Oswalt special. He comes on. He has some pretty vile stuff. Him and Posehn are pretty gross in their stand-up, but it's still pretty funny.
Okay.
Like, I think Alabama Doggy Fuck is the name of a movie title that Oswald came up with at one point. He's like, yeah, movie titles should, like, basically tell you what happens in their title. It's like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the best movie ever because you know exactly what the movie's about based on the title alone. Like, and these, like, rom-coms, like, what was that one you talked about today, Ben? Like, Just Go With It?
Yeah.
Like, you have no idea. It's, like, such a vague title. You have no idea what's going to happen. But
yeah.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know it's going to be in Texas. There's going to be a chainsaw. And, of course, a massacre.
Nice.
But, yeah, we should watch that movie for one of our episodes. Just saying.
Okay. All right.
Here, it's one of the scariest movies around.
I sadly have seen the, like, whatever, 2002 remake, but I've never seen the original.
Oh, the J. Beale remake, you mean? Produced
yes.
by Michael Bay?
Yeah, Platinum Dunes, what?
But I
what,
think...
One love, Platinum Dunes.
One up for love. What voice of Ben reference?
Please,
raise your finger up, guys, and just say one up for love, and everything's okay.
Tyler, just pepper this entire podcast with Boys to Men live concert references.
Boys to Men.
Anything else on your end, Tyler? That you've...
I'm gonna have to take it easy for a second so I can think of more Boys to Men references.
Okay.
You take your time. It's definitely worth it to do that,
right.
I think.
All right. Well, Dan Mecca, let's go to you. What have you been consuming?
All right. So I'm going to go quick through a couple. I saw... Finally, I don't even know if finally is the right word, but I saw Puss in Boots, which got nominated for an Oscar
mm-hmm.
In the animated category. And it's kind of exactly what you expect from DreamWorks. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's cute and cuddly. And they're really, you know, DreamWorks is really good at, you know, making funny pop culture. Really, you know, relevant movies with a lot of visual flair. And so there are like a couple of scenes in this movie that are actually fantastic to look at. Like there's a scene involving this like cloud world in this whole thing that's really, really pretty. And that was interesting. But in general, it's not. I really don't know how this movie got nominated over The Adventures of Tintin or mm-hmm. Arthur Christmas. But even still, it was better than I thought. And it's kind of cool listening to Antonio Banderas and Salma Hayek you know act next to each other if you like the Desperado and Once Upon a Time in Mexico movies so you know check it out if you're bored on a Saturday night and if you don't have kids. If you have kids, obviously rent it immediately. And another one that I saw that's just a good movie to check out is called Detour. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this movie. It's from like 1945.
I saw it. It's available on Netflix Instant right now. I was gonna watch it
tonight. Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that make it amazing. The first and most amazing thing about it is that it's 67 minutes long. So it's like, it's totally streamlined. You can watch it in an hour, and it's, you know, you'll get everything that you would expect in a feature film with, like, you know, in 30 minutes less than you, you know, you usually expect to get it. And it's kind of like the, it's kind of like a Coen Brothers movie 40 years before the Coen Brothers started making movies. It's just a very strange film noir about a dude who's trying to get to LA to see his like sweetheart. And he, you know, is hitchhiking, and he picks the wrong hitchhiker, and crazy things happen after that. And, you know, I won't go into details, but it's just, you know, kind of a twist after twist, but they're all very strange and wonderful. And so I definitely recommend it. It's actually Errol Morris's favorite movie, The Documentarian. So it's definitely well worth his label, and it's on Watch Instant, so you have no excuse.
Cool.
And then the third one that was kind of more of a one I wanted to talk about was Wonderland. You guys ever heard of that movie?
With the one with Val Kilmer where he plays a porn star?
Yeah, he plays John Holmes, who's like, you know, arguably the most famous porn star of all time, who was rumored to have a 14-inch penis. I don't know if, that's...
Oh, my God.
No.
That's circus freak, man.
Okay, check this out, because I did a little research, obviously, after seeing the movie. And 14-inch penis rumored with 12-inch circumference. What?
No.
Yep. I swear to God, look it up. Wikipedia.
It's a barrel, like a barrel-sized penis?
It's a shotgun penis is what it is.
Wow.
It's it's insane. But it was totally panned when it came out in 2003, directed by this NYU grad named James Cox. Who has this awesome short called Atomic Tabasco, which you can watch on YouTube. And it's he made it in like 1999. That one's I recommend checking out as well. But this is like his second feature, and people hated it. And Kate Bosworth is in it, and people hated her. But you know what? It's actually a really interesting movie. Val Kilmer's great. It's like part of his like little string of good performances before he decided to stop being good again. You know, it was like when he was making Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Salt and Sea and like all these cool, strange movies before he started making straight to DVD movies. It's an interesting movie. If you like, you know, if you like Tarantino like style and you just kind of interesting crime stories, it's all about the Wonderland murders, which John Holmes was supposedly, you know, part of, where all these drug dealers got killed on this road called Wonderland. And so it's just interesting, and they don't tell it chronologically. So it's like one of these, you know, this person's telling their version of the story, this other person's telling their other version of the story. So it's all about, you know how much you trust the narrator, and it's just an interesting movie to watch, and it's just nice to see Val Kilmer trying. So
Tyler, have you seen Wonderland?
No, I've seen The Salt and Sea, though.
Okay.
How good is The Salt and Sea?
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome.
Doesn't he have, like, chest and back tattoos in that one, Ben?
Yes, yeah.
Does he have, like, Salt and Sea tattooed on his chest? Is that... I can't remember.
I think there's some sort of, like, full back tattoo, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, he's got, like, a crazy back Salt and Sea tattoo, yeah. There's a lot of drugs in that. There's a lot of drugs in this.
Yeah, and I remember seeing Wonderland like probably like 07 or something like that on DVD, and I remember there being like some pretty decent action kind of in the middle. You're talking about the drug. There's a scene where they like break into this guy's house basically, right? And try to take drugs from him or something, and like all this crap goes wrong and like things get really out of hand. I don't remember a lot about that movie, but I do remember that as being kind of a standout sequence, and it was shot really well if I recall correctly too. So
yeah, it's a really kinetic movie. You know, if there was one word to describe it, it's just you have a lot of moving frames and a lot of just really, really quickly cut scenes. And Dylan McDermott's in it, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess he's kind of gained new relevance because he was in that show on FX that I cannot remember, American Horror Story.
Yeah.
Exactly. So he's okay in it. You know, he's not the best actor, but he tries really hard. And it's just worth checking out because it's insane. And so cool. I recommend it.
And what was the other one you wanted to talk about, Dan?
Well, speaking of insane, if I may give myself a segue, I watched the Phantom for the first time last night.
Not the Phantom Menace, the Phantom.
The Phantom with Billy Zane from 1996.
Who else?
And it is a movie, all right.
I love when people describe movies like that. That's never a good sign.
No, like, here's the thing. I actually thoroughly enjoy this movie. And actually, the dude who wrote Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade wrote The Phantom, which I know, I swear to God. And the opening scene, the opening like 10-minute scene of The Phantom is literally like a scene from Indiana Jones. It's like, it's the opening of Raiders. They just do it again with the dad from Dexter, James Remar. And it's like, it's really pretty fucking good. And then The Phantom comes into the mix and he's wearing his, you know, purple leotard and you're kind of like, okay, all right. And then it's Billy Zane. And so then you're like, okay. But it's, you know, it's like really of its time. It's trying to be like what the Phantom was back in the 30s. Like, so like Billy Zane's the nicest superhero in the world and all the effects are, you know, it was in that weird 90s stage where green screen was still pretty, you know, not new, but you know, green screen was still pretty rudimentary.
Yeah. It was like really obvious when it was.
Exactly. So all the practical effects are refreshing, right? Because practical effects don't happen anymore. So you're kind of like, you know, there's a scene on a bridge where they actually shoot an action scene with stuntmen on a bridge. And you're like, oh my God, like that dude's actually hanging off of a bridge. Mm-hmm. And then there are other shots where it cuts to like Billy Zane hanging. And then you see the mat, you know, the mat underneath him. And you're just kind of like, oh, 1996. You know what I mean? Like, you were hysterical. But Treat Williams is the bad guy. So that's awesome.
Saw you tweet his name, and I've always loved this villain name. Why don't you tell people what it was?
His name is, get ready, it's Xander Drax. Okay? The only bad guy name better than that is the name Tobin Frost from Safe House.
Nice. Didn't they make a reference in The Phantom that his name begins and ends with an X? Or am I...
he says that. That's what's great about the movie. Like, it clearly knows how bad it is. That's kind of why I actually kind of liked it, because there's a scene where Treat Williams spells his name to somebody. And he goes, and he spells the whole name out, and then he goes, starts with an X, ends with an X. That's what he says. And you're just like, what is going on? But, you know, Catherine Zeta-Jones is in it. It was, like, one of her first big roles.
Yep.
Before The Mask of Zorro. Apparently, James Cameron loved Billy Zane so much in The Phantom that that was why he cast him as, you know, the bad guy in Titanic.
No way, really?
I swear to God. I don't know if that's true, but I read it. I don't know. You know, I feel like it could be true, but...
I hope James Cameron also liked the performance of the scientist in Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze.
Dude, great
that
reference.
That guy was in the Titanic 2.
Well played, sir. Well played. I hope that James Cameron loved Billy Zane in Sniper with Tom Baron. That's what I hope. But, yeah, it's just like...
I saw The Phantom a few years ago, and I feel like it actually holds up. Like, I remember liking it, you know?
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Like, it, as bad as you feel like it is, it's almost like The Rocketeer in that way.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Or, like, you know what it is? You know, it's a great example. It's kind of the way that a lot of people really, really enjoyed Captain America last year, because this was a movie, you know, that took that Spielbergian type of, like, populist entertainment that's not around anymore, because we kind of live in this more cynical, you know what I mean, world of, like, you know, gray or whatever. And then so like Captain America, you know, you have the good guy and the bad guy, and it's fun to just watch that and like feel like a kid again. And I feel like, you know, on a lesser level, The Phantom and The Rocketeer and The Shadow even those values like from the 90s. So it's fun to watch for sure.
Yeah, well, Dan, it's funny that you mentioned Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, because that's one of the movies that I want to talk about. I saw this on TV yesterday. I was tweeting about it a little bit, and I know that you and I had a little back and forth. And Tyler, I know that you're a big fan of this movie, especially in the
biggest
Indiana
fan.
Jones franchise. And you and I, years ago, or maybe a year ago, probably years ago now, multiple years ago, went back and reviewed all of the Indiana Jones films for notjustnewmovies.com, so people can check out our reviews back then. But
I wrote the one for Temple of Doom, just so you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I was the only one willing to take on that task.
Yeah.
That is quite a task, my friend. That is quite a task.
And I liked it. I liked Temple of Doom.
Did you really? I got to watch it again.
I'm not a fan of that one, but
me neither.
Pretty adventurous.
Last Crusade is the one that I wanted to mention just because I think it's worth bringing up, like, how amazing the opening and closing of that movie it really is. Like,
oh, that's right. You were talking about the River Phoenix thing.
Yeah, because, like, brilliant. The opening of the movie, like, I assume everybody's seen Indiana Jones and Last Crusade, but just the way that it starts out, and it's a kind of an origin story of Indiana Jones and how he comes to be the way that we've seen him in two full feature movies already. It's not like a flashback in Raiders or something like that. Like, they wait two movies deep, the start of the third one, to give you this
almost
little taste.
10 years.
Yeah, this little taste of how Indiana Jones kind of became Indiana Jones. And I just think, you know, in a world where we've got origin stories and prequels and all that kind of stuff, for a movie to be able to just condense all of that into one opening sequence of whatever, 15 or 20 minutes or something max, and like hit every piece that you need to hit from a storytelling perspective is just fantastic. And I mean, I think that, like, really speaks to Spielberg and his talents. And, you know, Danny mentioned that kind of populist entertainment that he brings. And I think there's really, like, people can bash Spielberg all they want, because I know that that's kind of been one of those in vogue things to do over the past few years, because I think arguably people could say that, like, the past, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 movies that he's made don't even come close to the start of his career or some of the other stuff that he's done. But
well,
I think,
Ben, those people are douchebags.
I have to agree with you on this one. I think they're douchey.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with that assessment. I'm just saying that's kind of like the vibe that's out there right now. And
have they not even seen Minority Report? No, I'm kidding.
Okay. Yeah, Minority Report's really great. We need to do a whole episode on that one day. But yeah, I don't know. I saw it on TV and I watched it all the way through. And I mean, I've seen this movie 100 times and it's captivating. And the very end too, like, you know, this movie is like basically, it's kind of a remake of Raiders with a father figure in there too. Yeah. So you've got like the scene where at the end of Raiders, everybody opens up the Lost Ark and the lightning bolts shoot through everybody and like the dude's face melts off and stuff. You've got kind of like an analogous equivalent to that in the end of Last Crusade when they're drinking from the Holy Grail and Walter Donovan drinks it and just like turns into the guy from Tales of the Crypt or the Crypt Keeper or whatever. I mean, it's really
great cameo,
like,
by the way.
What's that?
Great cameo, by the way.
By the Crypt Keeper, yes.
Somebody should do like a side-by-side, like, screenshot comparison of the similarities between Last Crusade and Raiders, because even from, like, locations and stuff, like, there's a sequence when, right before Indy and Sean Connery and Denholm Elliott and John Rhys-Davies get onto this big tank sequence, kind of like right in the middle of the movie, that's basically the scene from Raiders when where the really long car chase happens and he goes underneath the car. It's like there's very similar imagery and stuff in there, and like it seems clear to me that after Temple of Doom, which, as Tyler already mentioned, you can go back and read his review of that.
Yeah.
After Temple of Doom, they wanted to kind of get back to the way that they were telling the stories originally with Raiders, and I think Last Crusade is almost like a carbon copy in many ways of Raiders, and I think that's why personally I like those two best out of any of the Indiana Jones films. But yeah. Do you guys have any thoughts on The Last Crusade in general or anything like that?
Well, Ben, I have to say two things. Props for using the word analogous, AP word of the day. Well done.
Thank you.
And
put a quarter in there.
Put a quarter in that jar. And then the other thing is, I love The Last Crusade is my personal favorite in the Indiana Jones movie, and I think that doesn't get much better than the scene at the end of the film where right after Walter Donovan turns into the Crypt Keeper, that knight turns to Indiana Jones and says, "He chose poorly."
Yeah.
That is gotta be my favorite line ever, because you're just like, yeah, no, I know he chose poorly because he just turned into the Crypt Keeper.
He's a giant pile of dust on the ground right now.
Thank you, 700-year-old knight, for telling me something I already knew. But
sarcasm wasn't around during the Middle Ages, so like Indy gets it, but the knight who said the joke doesn't even get it.
I love it. I absolutely love that part to my dying day. It's, oh, God, amazing.
It's weird, but, my favorite line is right near there where he falls into he steps on the wrong letter.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
like,
yes.
He curses himself for not knowing Latin. And it's just like, that's such, like, only Indiana Jones in the whole world of human beings, fictional and non-fictional, only Indiana Jones can curse himself for not knowing proper Latin.
What did he say? He's like, it starts with an I or whatever. He's just, yes, I love it. That. Oh, Jones, what a great movie.
And that whole, like, the trials and tribulations of Indiana Jones, like the three trials that he has to go through at the really end, at the very end of the film, is really awesome. Like, that's one of my favorite parts of any movie,
of course,
ever. Yeah, like, just the way that it's cut back and forth to Connery kind of like whispering guidance to him that Indy can't actually hear, but he kind of knows, because, you know, earlier in the movie they showed that Connery's this big disciplinarian that kind of like hammered all these ideals home to Indy as he was growing up. And so, I mean, it's just so good. So,
yeah. And also when you get older and you realize that Sean Connery and Harrison Ford slept with the same woman, that's always nice.
Really?
That's
weird.
A nice one. Yeah. I mean, and awesome.
In the realm of Spielberg and his, like, his kind of thematic father son stuff. I mean, we talked a little bit about that in our Hook episode with Matt Patches recently. Like, that's like a big thing that Spielberg does in his movies is really deal with the, like, delve into these relationships between fathers and their kids. And that little subplot of them sleeping with the same woman is like, that has got to be some sort of Freudian nightmare or something. I don't know what, but that's like one of the weirder things he's done in any of his movies, I think. But
I like the idea of Henry messing with him, like alluding to the fact that he slept with that girl.
But wait,
like just to mess with funny. Indiana Jones.
But Tyler, you think it happened, right? I mean,
yeah, probably. Elsa.
I mean, come on, he's Sean Connery. Come on, I mean, he's not going to do that.
Yeah,
he's
not going to sleep alone. Come on.
Yeah.
Hey, come on,
James Bond.
And then the one other thing that I just wanted to briefly touch on was I got a chance to go to Jason Reitman's live read of Reservoir Dogs at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art a couple nights ago, and because it's February and Black History Month, he recast Reservoir Dogs with a 99% black cast. Patton Oswalt was the only white member of the cast. He did like the voice of the radio DJ and a couple little tiny like cop parts here and there. But Cuba Gooding Jr., Anthony Mackie, Terrence Howard, Anthony Anderson, Chi McBride, Common, and Lawrence Fishburne were like the main cast members, and it was really, really great.
Did they screen Red Tails after the reading? Or I'm just wondering.
No.
Okay. That's the kind of racial comment we stopped the show for, Mecca.
No, because, you know what, man? Whatever. I'm done.
No.
That sounds awesome, though, seriously.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and I think, like, the biggest thing that everybody was wondering going in was, like, who is Reitman going to cast in Harvey Keitel's role? Because if you guys have seen Reservoir Dogs, if you remember that movie, Keitel just gives this kind of towering performance where, you know, he's older than a lot of the other guys in the movie, and he really takes on this authoritative figure and really kind of commands every frame that he's in. And I was wondering if they're going to go with somebody like Denzel or even like Morgan Freeman or somebody like that, but they ended up getting Fishburne, and he was awesome. He was the best performer of the whole night, and he really he brought that same kind of gravitas to the role that Harvey Keitel did. And I think Tarantino probably would have been proud of the reading. The reason Jason Reitman chose that script was he wanted to like totally reverse the races of everybody that was cast in it, just to see if the story changed and see if that kind of dynamic added anything or kind of like switched things up. He's like, before the event, he was like, you know, this could be the same movie. It could be totally, or the same kind of vibe. It could be totally different. I don't know. We're just going to find out. So it was really interesting. And I think Tarantino's script is like so Danny used the word kinetic earlier. I mean, if a script can be kinetic, I mean, Reservoir Dogs is. And I think the race thing doesn't even matter. It's just like it's great actors reading a great script. And there were some interesting kind of reverse moments where, like, racial epithets are thrown around in the script a little bit. And, like, Cuba Gooding Jr., every time one would be read aloud by one of his fellow actors, would kind of, like, glance at the audience and, like, raise his eyebrow a little bit as if to say, like, this is a little weird. But yeah, it was good.
Who did Common play?
Oh, Common was... Common was Mr. Brown, which was Quentin Tarantino's part in the movie.
Oh, cool.
So he was really only in it in the opening scene. And then he voiced Marvin Nash, the cop who gets tortured by Mr. Blonde a little bit later on, too. And they played Steeler's Wheel, Stuck in the Middle with You, over the loudspeakers in the auditorium when they were doing that kind of iconic torture scene. So they stepped it up, and it was really awesome. So I just wanted to kind of touch on that. And I wrote up a piece at geektyrant.com about that, so you guys can search, Google search Geek Tyrant Jason Reitman Reservoir Dogs, and you'll find it. So,
dude, we should get our podcast friends together and do a live Skype read of a famous movie.
That might be kind of cool.
Perhaps The Phantom, Dan Mecca?
Oh, I think we have an idea. I think we're pretty much halfway there.
Yeah, we could read it and then set some music to it, maybe some sound effects. I don't know.
Wow.
Shoddy the Catherine Zeta-Jones role.
Tyler, I like where your head's at. We might have to seriously talk about
that. Hey, if they can make money and sell tickets, that kind of stuff, we can do it for free.
I like your mentality.
And be as, if not more, popular because of it.
And I like your ambition. To
Sam Neill as...
Yeah.
Billy Zane in The Phantom.
That would be the best, is if it was just us and, like, Eric D. Snyder and, like, a couple of the other people that we've had on as guests, and then, like, right. Like Sam Elliott or somebody. One other person.
Superstar.
Yeah, it couldn't be a superstar.
It would have to be, like, Eric Bogosian. You know what I mean? Like, just some random, like, B actor you haven't heard of. But we should do it.
All right, well, with that, let's go ahead and jump into our review of Beetlejuice.
From the director of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Adam and Barbara are
ghosts. What's the good of being a ghost if you can't frighten people away?
Their house is being haunted by the living.
Maybe the house could use a little remodeling.
And they can't scare them into leaving.
Dad, it's a little late to be neurotic.
So they're calling on Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice!
Who's no ordinary ghost.
Yeah, you don't want his help.
Can you be scary?
What do you think of this?
Now, the party's over.
You want somebody out of the house, I want to get somebody out of your house.
But the fun has just begun.
It's showtime.
All right, so Beetlejuice came out in 1988. It was directed by Tim Burton and stars Alec Baldwin, Gina Davis, Winona Ryder, and Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice. For me, this was my first time seeing this movie. Tyler, Dan, let's start with you. Had you seen this movie before, and what's your kind of relationship with it? Did you watch it a lot growing up or anything like that? And what did you think about it this most recent time that you checked it out?
So, yeah, I definitely watched this movie when I was very young, like many people, you know, my age, and didn't quite understand it the way, obviously, when I watched it a couple days ago, I do now, but... I was always more of an Edward Scissorhands kid, but they are, you know, obviously both Tim Burton, very similar in a lot of ways. But this movie, I feel like, is a lot more dark, actually, in a weird way than Edward Scissorhands, which I don't know if I knew that when I was younger, but rewatching it, I see it and I dig it. I respect how kind of dark it gets, especially with obviously the Beetlejuice character. And I think the thing that stood out most for me watching it again is all the practical effects and the stop motion animation and the production design, you know, which obviously is what Tim Burton has always been, you know, recognized for, and you know, people love him for that. But I kind of forgot how amazing Catherine O'Hara is in it as the mother. Mm-hmm. So those were these, you know, the big things. And also the biggest thing actually was the fact that Michael Keaton doesn't show up until almost an hour into the movie, really.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy because it's a 90-minute movie and he's really in it only for like 30 minutes. And he's almost like in like two scenes, like, because the end of the movie is just whirlwind. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's a lot of buildup. And then like those last 30 minutes is just jam packed with just crazy effects and all that dark stuff that I was talking about. So I was kind of fascinated by it. I really enjoyed it.
All right, Tyler, what about you? What'd you think?
Yeah, I saw it in bits and pieces too back when I was a kid. But you were an Edward Scissors kid, Mecca. I was a Pee-wee's Big Adventure kid. And there's a lot of stop motion stuff, especially during like the dream sequences and like the strange semi-truck driver and stuff like that. And seeing that same animation in these older Tim Burton movies are like kind of unsettling because I was kind of uncomfortable with it as a child. And I think that stuck with me. And so seeing that same kind of look and artistic effect of like these snakes and this world that is kind of outside in the astral world. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like bizarrely, it was like, I don't want to be there, but it's cool to look at kind of thing, where I'm like, I would be scared out of my mind if I was actually there, but it's kind of cool to look at from the safety of my living room. So the whole movie of Beetlejuice was kind of had that feeling for me, because I was like, I'm not really sure what's going to happen next, because I saw it when I was a kid. But I know Beetlejuice is pretty funny, but like you said, Dan, it was like, he didn't show up for a really, really long time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you would think like he was there, he would be like like Rob Schneider in whatever his movie is, where he's in like every scene. It's like, no, you have all these other characters, carrying the movie, and Beetlejuice just happens to be like almost like a minor character almost. Idea of Beetlejuice is bigger than the actual character.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, it seems to be kind of, I don't know, like almost mismarketed or something. I mean, if you look at the poster, it's Beetlejuice front and center and Gene Davis and Alec Baldwin like off to the side, but it really is kind of their movie. And I don't know, I mean, for somebody who wasn't expecting that going into it and this being my first viewing and everything, I kind of liked it because of that. I think Michael Keaton is like so great and weird and really bizarre as this character, but I think the character of Beetlejuice like probably served the movie better in a smaller role than concentrating on him for every single scene, because it kind of makes him funnier in a way, you know, like you don't have time to be tired of his shtick because he's only in it for 30 or 35 minutes or something. So, you know, that was like kind of like how, what is that character? Aldous Snow in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I really liked that character then, but then when they gave him his own movie and get him to the Greek, it was like, this kind of wears thin after a little while. You know, it didn't really have that same pop.
And it's funny that you bring that up, because I was thinking while watching the movie, you know, when you watch these older movies, and Burton is a great filmmaker to use as a template, because, you know, he's still making movies every, you know, couple of years. I don't know that a studio would let that happen these days. I don't know that you could pitch a studio, you know, Beetlejuice starring Michael Keaton, who at the time was arguably the biggest star of those three. Alec Baldwin was kind of a star then, but and say to them, okay, you know, read the script, and, you know, by the way, the title character and Michael Keaton, Batman, you know, is going to be only coming in an hour, you know, into the movie and going to be in it for 30 minutes. And I think it's interesting when you compare that movie to Alice in Wonderland, where Johnny Depp is playing a very similar type of character than Mad Hatter, you know, in, you know, combined, you know, when you think about both stories, very similar character. And they introduce him so early in the movie, and he definitely wears thin by the end. And you think, I wonder if they had done the Beetlejuice formula with Johnny Depp in Alice in Wonderland, things would have went a little bit better for that film.
Yeah.
So I'd be curious to hear a studio head talk about like doing a movie like Beetlejuice today, you know, and that.
It's kind of interesting because
they're talking about, I'm sure.
Well, they are. Yeah.
News, right?
Michael Keaton was just talking, just giving an interview to somebody, or no, I'm sorry. It was Seth Graham Smith, the guy who wrote Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. he got hired to write Beetlejuice 2, and he met up with, he was doing interviews for Abraham Lincoln and was doing the press rounds and stuff, and said that he met with Michael Keaton like earlier that week. This was only like, this was this past week. So talking about Beetlejuice 2, and he really wants to do it. And, you know, Tim Burton's got a couple other things on his plate before they would eventually get to it. But, you know, everybody's saying like, oh, yeah, it's, you know, it, there's a scriptwriter in the, you know, a script is being written and everybody's interested. So we'll see what happens. So, I mean, it's not inconceivable that we'll see Beetlejuice 2 on the big screen in the next like 5 years or something. So
and it would obviously be called Beetlejuice Mummy Killer. Right. That would be the, that would be the movie.
Beetlejuicier, maybe. I don't know.
Two Beetle, two juicier.
I like that one better, yeah. So
sold. You just made $1 million.
Oh my god, that's amazing.
Yeah, that worked out there.
So what did you guys think of the supporting performances? I mean, I guess I say supporting performances, but I meant everybody but Michael Keaton, which just is kind of weird based on the conversation that we just had. But what did you guys think about Alec Baldwin and Jeffrey Jones, who played Rooney in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and Catherine O'Hara, the writer, and all of them? So Tyler, what about you? What did you think about the cast?
Yeah, I really like Baldwin and Davis as the two dead people. Like, I just thought their little trip through death was pretty awesome. Like, the whole idea of that happening when you bite the dust is kind of exciting. I mean, not exciting enough to actually kick the bucket, but you get what I'm saying. Yeah, like, I like Alec Baldwin. I like, you know, when he's in movies, I like the man. I like the character. Alec Baldwin, like Jack Donaghy. You know, it's kind of like who we associate Alec Baldwin with now, but he's kind of like that, but not really.
His character in 30 Rock, for those of you who don't watch the show. But
Well, what's interesting is, you know, you got to think about back in 1988, he was being cast against type in that movie, right? Because he was an action star, kind of. And so, well,
yeah, he hadn't done was, I guess, first, I'm trying to think what his first big movie was. I'm thinking Big Hunt for Red October, but that wasn't until like, what, 91?
I think that was 89. I think that was 89, actually. Okay. I think that came right after.
And then Michael Keaton wasn't even Batman yet. That was 89, too.
Was it?
Yeah. So I'm looking right now, and Baldwin was in two movies before Beetlejuice, Forever Lulu and She's Having a Baby. And then he was in Hunt for Red October in 1990. So it was like, just a couple years after.
Wow, you're totally right. So, yeah, that Michael Keaton was Beetlejuice before he was Batman. My goodness.
I think he was Mr. Mom before Beetlejuice, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, I think you're... Yep, he was, yeah. And he was... And let's not forget, he was Johnny Dangerously as well. Oh, nice. Which is an amazing movie.
Other than Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin, like, that was a cool little plot point. But then, I mean, the family that moves in, I mean, they're pretty entertaining. I like Catherine O'Hara, famous for her role in Home Alone series, I think. Yeah, that's where I first saw her.
Where?
And in Home Alone.
Okay.
Don't confuse her with Maureen O'Hara, a actress 30 years prior to this, I would say. but she was actually in another Tim Burton film. She was one of the voices in Nightmare Before Christmas. She was one of the little monsters that work for Oogie Boogie.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway. But yeah, I mean, like you said, Ben, these aren't the minor characters. These are basically the main characters. So, and I really enjoyed the film, so I think a lot of credit lies with the, as we've called them, the secondary characters, because, you know, Michael Keaton, he has a good performance, but if it was just that and just shitty actors carrying the movie, it probably wouldn't have been as popular.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think Baldwin and Davis, like, they don't get, because, I mean, like I said, it's my first viewing of the movie, and all I've heard about is Michael Keaton from Beetlejuice. And nobody ever talks about how great Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis are in this movie, and I think they are really good. Like, you know, there's the, like, Baldwin is kind of an interesting actor, because he kind of runs the gamut from kind of playing the straight man to really going over the top with a lot of his roles. And here it's kind of a little bit of a mix of both, like they're, but more kind of on like the comedic side of things than like ever into the like super dramatic stuff that he's done. But there's one line that he says, he's trying to convince Gina Davis about wearing these sheets and going out and scaring the family. And she's like, these are so stupid. Like, why are we doing this? And he's like, think of them as death shrouds. Just like the way that he gets really into it and kind of embraces that, like their position in this nether world and stuff.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting. Cause he kind of accepts it right away. He's like, I think we're dead.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I guess, you know, we get to chill in the house now. And she's like, I don't know what to do. Like, she's kind of freaking out about it, but the thought of them dead together kind of comforted me, even as an audience member, because it's like, you know, if I were to die, I would want someone to kind of do it with, to experience it. I don't know,
yeah, sure,
what happens after we die.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying, like, if that was it, you know, I'd probably be okay with that.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of interesting to even, like, we're introduced to this couple at the beginning and then they die and you're like, well, that's it. But no, you get to experience their relationship after they die.
Yeah.
Which is just kind of mind blowing for me. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But yeah, Gina Davis too. Like, I really liked her, like, the way she played it, because I've really only seen Gina Davis in a couple things. League of Their Own, where she was kind of like a stern older sister who, you know, she kind of didn't really smile a lot. I don't know why. And then in The Fly, where, and I've seen her in other things as well, but like here I generally enjoyed her company, like somebody I'd like to date, if you're listening, Gina. 20 years later, I'll yeah, man. But
what's up, Gina? What's up?
Yeah, what's up, Gina?
What's up,
JG? GD?
GD?
What's going on, GD date, man? So yeah, I like both of them, and I like Winona Ryder just because I got the hots for her, but she was like 15 in this, so that doesn't.
That was like her third movie. This was like her third movie, Winona Ryder.
Right.
Beetlejuice. It was before Heathers. It was before all those movies that she became famous for. So
Aliens 3 or one of those Alien movies.
Dude, Resurrection, bro. Resurrection.
Sorry, dude.
One of the interesting things that I thought this movie did, from, I guess this is probably like in this, I mean, it's a screenplay thing, was depict the afterlife as this weird, like, bureaucracy, like a giant DMV kind of. Dan, what did you think about, like, I guess everything from that concept to the way it was done, like production design and everything, like just the afterlife in general and the way it shows up on screen in this movie?
Oh, well, I love all of that stuff. All of the, I mean, like you're saying, Tyler, all of the death stuff is so well designed and so beautifully realized. Like, you know, when they're sitting in that room and all these different creatures are sitting around them, you know, the guy with the small head and the woman who's blue and the guy who's the guy who's smoking and he's like a skeleton, and he offers Alec Baldwin a cigarette and Alec Baldwin turns him down, and then he's like, I'm trying to cut down myself, you know what I mean? just like jokes that are just so, you know, funny and, you know, almost like slapstick. And and obviously, like you were saying, Ben, the it's like very Terry Gilliam, you know what I mean? I feel like There's a lot of Brazil that's in Beetlejuice and vice versa, in terms of you know, the way that both of those directors were working in the 80s. And you know, and then the, you know, just a lot of real life things that they bring to the whole death thing. I feel, you know, it was done 25 years ago now, and or 15 years ago now. Yeah, 15 years ago now. And when you look back, you're
now you had it right.
No, yeah, 25. You're right.
Oh my God, 25. That's insane.
Yeah,
25 years ago.
Freaking old.
But it, Jesus. But yeah, so you know, it's one of those things, like, looking back now, you think about movies that came out 10 years after that or something, and you're like, wow, you know, Tim Burton and all these, you know, animators and all of his, you know cohorts were doing things that were going to be, you know, in movies like Inception, you know, by Warner Brothers for like $200 million budgets, you know, 20 years later. So it's just kind of interesting to think about. But
He has a weird brain that I think only comes out in his movies, and to be able to experience somebody's mind like that is, I think,
it's just fascinating.
Just amazing. Yeah, exactly. Like, and the idea that he had a certain vision and there weren't any CG capabilities, or, you know, and he said, I'm going to have to build all of this stuff or mold all of this stuff to get what I'm thinking on film.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you hit on something too, Dan, when you're talking about like Burton's career influencing other things, because, you know, he started out, I think, as an animator at Pixar at one point.
Really?
And then Monsters, Inc., the way that that movie kind of depicts like this monster world is very similar to the way that death is presented in this movie. You know, you like the whole bureaucracy and kind of like, it's a job, it's a place, it's a whole nother world outside of the realm that we kind of understand and normally operate in. So yeah, maybe Burton kind of laid the seed for the way that Monsters, Inc. was eventually depicted. I don't know. Tyler,
well, go ahead. No, I was going to that point, you know, one of his first short films, which is also, it's available on YouTube if you guys listening want to check it out, called Frankenweenie, is about a young boy who, his dog dies, and then he brings him back to life like Frankenstein, and it becomes like, you know, an undead dog, if you will.
Yeah.
He's finally got to make into a feature film. Yeah, but that's, that movie's coming out later this year. He finally got to make his short that he made in 1984 into a feature that's coming out later this year. So I am so curious to see what this 30-year-old idea of Burton's will look like now that he's been making movies for 30 years. Because, you know, people keep talking and ragging on. There's this like odd hate for Tim Burton these days, which I still kind of don't really understand. Like, yes, Planet of the Apes wasn't that great, and yes, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory had a lot of problems, but I don't really get, a lot of people call him a hack now, which I don't really understand, but
that makes
no
sense.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what this, like, you know, idea that he's been, that's been gestating for decades will look like, you know. So that's exciting.
I think like, yeah, hack isn't really the right word. I mean, I sometimes feel that totally some of his movies are watered down versions of his previous films, but since he came up with the original films in the first place, he's really not hacky in that sense. I mean, and like Corpse Bride, I mean, I need to go back and rewatch Corpse Bride, because I think there is a good movie in there somewhere, but when I watched it initially, because it wasn't as good as Nightmare Before Christmas, I think that was why I wrote it off, and I was like, oh, he's just trying to do Nightmare Before Christmas again. This is stupid. But I think if you, you know, kind of watch him over and over again, you kind of see that he just used the same techniques to tell something else.
Yeah. I think Burton's also one of these artists, you know, because he is an artist who, his movies deserve time to you know, to seed and to gestate and to really think about them. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I'm sure when Beetlejuice came out in 1988, you know what I mean? It wasn't a, you know, people didn't call it a classic. People didn't say, oh my gosh, you know, it wasn't a universally critically acclaimed movie. Maybe I'm wrong, but I really feel like, you know, like a lot of his movies, people are going to go back and they're going to find the creativity that he has and, you know, respect for it.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for like watching somebody's movie outside of the week to week wide releases in a theater, because you're like subconsciously comparing them to other things that are coming out at that time and stuff like that. And if you're able to kind of pull a movie out from, you know, prior years and just take a look at it separate from all that stuff, it really does add like a different perspective to it. And I think, Tyler, kind of what you're saying with Nightmare Before Christmas and Corpse Bride, I actually haven't even seen Corpse Bride, but I heard it wasn't that great. But maybe it was him, Burton, kind of trying to, like, wanting to direct something like that instead of just produce it like he did for Nightmare Before Christmas. Maybe it was him just trying to, like, work through those kind of creative juices and saying, like, hey, maybe I can take a shot at this myself, and yeah, it's not the same thing that I produced all those years ago, but maybe I can kind of recapture some of that. So yeah, I don't know, maybe watching that separate from expectations of comparison with Nightmare Before Christmas might yield a different result, I guess.
Can we talk about how many weird, just like generally weird things happen in this movie that
sure.
don't, like, they're like a plot, like, other than those people dying and dealing with death, like, there really isn't a plot. It's just weird things happening in order, and then you come to a conclusion, at least, with Beetlejuice.
Yeah, I mean, you've got an entire sequence set to Daylight Come and Me One Go Home, which just, like, goes on seemingly forever with everybody doing choreographed dances around a table, and it's just like, what is this movie? What are we watching right now?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when Beetlejuice, the snake monster thing, is just so disturbing. I was watching that last night or the night before. Tyler, kind of like what you were saying, I was totally brought back to childhood, and I was just like, where are my covers, and why am I not under them right now? I was totally creeped out. Like, Winona Ryder, you know, she plays this, you know, she's young in the movie, she plays a young girl, and like, she finally gets, you know, scared in that scene, and you're totally, at least I was totally with her. I mean, I'm, you know, 20s now, I feel like I'm a man in some respects, and I'm watching this movie, and I'm just like, I need to change my pants, because I am so freaked out by what's happening, just like, Beetlejuice snake. Ugh. So,
well, yeah. With that, and what was some of the other, you mentioned the very beginning when you first started talking about the movie, Dan, some of the dark places that it gets to. Talk a little bit about what some of those that you.
Yeah, I mean, saw. That's obviously the one that immediately jumps to me. But just some of the things that it just says about it's, you know, says about death. You know, it's kind of one of these quote unquote not a children's movie, but I mean, like, you know, a child could watch this film.
Well,
like,
yeah, they made an animated TV series for kids.
Exactly. And so so it's like, you know, me and Tyler watching this, like many others when we were kids as well. So it's like, you know, what does it say about death? You know, because you got to think about it. What it's saying, right, is like, you know, you don't go immediately to heaven. So there's this like weird religious thing that's being implied. And, you know, you do have somewhat of a control. So there's a purgatory thing going on, which is like decidedly Christian and Catholic. But it's also there are all these other denominations happening with like these creatures, you know what I mean? And there's like blue people. And then you have the whole, you know, when they walk out of the house, they fall into like 1920s German expressionism, right? With like these crazy Salvador Dali mixed with, you know,
sand, you know, monsters.
Dr. Caligari, like, you know, crazy, you know, Fritz Lang, you know, like every, you know, weird artist from the early 1900s just mashed into one. And it's just, it's really disturbing. And like, I think that goes back to the stop motion thing. Like, I think stop motion almost becomes more disturbing because in it not being real, it almost feels more real. You know what I mean? Because maybe it's nostalgia or something like that, but there's nothing in Alice in Wonderland, you know, or even Sweeney Todd. I mean, you know, that, you know, is quite as creepy as like the snake monsters. And like in the beginning, when Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin are getting chased, you know, when they walk out of the house, by the snake monster, like the first time you see it, and then he goes to eat Gina Davis, and then like another snake monster jumps out of its mouth.
Yeah,
like that is some creepy shit. Like if you're seven and you're watching that movie, that doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? So, I dig how weird and deep he got with that, with all those implications. So, I mean, it's definitely one of his most dark and metaphorical movies.
Yeah, and then you've got like the whole crazy ceremony at the end too, where Beetlejuice is basically like, you know, he's trying to get Winona Ryder's character to make a deal with the devil, kind of, and just like marry herself off to this crazy weird guy, and like who knows what his like true motive is for that, but it just seemed like really weird and creepy and dirty, and just like this is not something that should be happening, but she has to kind of make the sacrifice for her like surrogate parents that in Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis that have come to
rescue her.
Like, it's so interesting that her character, I mean, you know, I guess growing up in the 80s and 90s and stuff, you like, I think we were witness to kind of the rise of like the goth kid. And there's a lot of stereotypes associated with that. And for me, I was worried when I first saw Winona Ryder's character that she was just going to be a collection of stereotypes. But she actually feels like a real character in this, like a real person. It's not just like, oh, I'm going to sit in the dark in my room just because and listen to bad music and stuff. You know, like there's real things going on with that character. And she actually does form like legitimate real relationships with adults. They just happen to be dead, and they're more meaningful than the ones that she has with her actual living parents. So I don't know, I think there's a lot to dig into with this movie. But
yeah, because for the most part you would think she wouldn't be scared of anything because she's talking to ghosts and she's not scared, but then there are some instances where she does scream and is frightened, and you're like, oh well, she's you know, she is just a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you kind of, you know, she tries to be tough, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But, it was cool, Dan, you making that connection, like, nostalgia, like, and I think, again, when you're a kid and you're watching that, like, I guess for us, because we watched those Tim Burton movies, like, anything not real, because we see it, you know, in that form, we assume, like you said, that's what it looks like.
Exactly.
Like you said, the more and more it becomes almost not real, that's what we perceive is real, like what a sand monster or a sand snake would look like. And for some reason, movies back then, they always liked this idea of like a big desert as being this like expansive no land that you could land in. Like, have you guys ever seen Phantasm 2?
No.
No, I have not.
At one point, like these little midgets try to grab these people into their dimension, and you like enter the dimension very briefly, and it's like this expansive desert that would be like the worst place to end up in. And so anytime I think of deserts and like this weird, like you said, Salvador Dali, or this weird artistic thing, even like Dune, maybe like the desert planet on Dune, it's like, this is probably the worst place you could end up if you're in an 80s movie.
Even know, dude, even of... Wayne's World 2, man. Don't forget Wayne's World 2.
Oh yeah, when he's talking to Sammy Davis Jr.
Exactly.
Nice.
The desert.
But yeah, it's very and Pee Wee's Playhouse, the show that came after the movie, had a lot of weird stuff that they kind of drew from the Tim Burton film. That again, kind of leaves a kid kind of dreaming the wrong kind of dreams. Very bizarre things.
Nice. Well, yeah, we covered a lot of the stuff that I had written down, so if you guys have anything else to bring up, we can do that, or we can just go ahead and do, like, kind of concluding thoughts from everyone. So, yeah, Tyler, let's go to you.
Yeah, I mean, there's really no concrete way to describe this movie. You just have to watch it and then discuss it later. Like, you know, that's my suggestion. Just watch it, and then we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing I could really say that will spur you to watch it. I mean, it's very interesting. It's very artistic. It's very Tim Burton. If that's not enough, then, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think,
next week.
I think saying it's very Tim Burton has, like, different connotations. Kind of like what Dan was saying, you know, it's like, oh, there's people that have kind of crapped on him recently. But yeah. I think it is Tim Burton, like, very much a Tim Burton movie. But it's also pretty good, you know? Like, there are some movies of his that try to do similar things and just don't connect in the way that this one did.
And this one doesn't have, like... I mean, Edward Scissorhands is pretty dark, but it also has some tender moments. Like, Beetlejuice, there's hardly really any, like, slow-down moments or tender moments. It's, like, all really weird.
Yeah.
Like, it's just weird thing after weird thing happening.
Yeah, all the tender stuff in Beetlejuice happens in the first 10 minutes before Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis die.
Yeah, it's true.
Then it's just, like, straight-on, like, weirdness after that. But, yeah, Dan, what do you think? Concluding thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think having, you know, recently watched it again, I'm so glad that you guys told me to be on this, asked me to be on this podcast, and I was able to rewatch it. It's awesome. And I think it's one of his best movies, one of the best movies I've seen by him. And totally, you know, I always try to think about what young filmmakers should watch, or young aspiring filmmakers, because I feel like that's a big part of this whole thing, you know, why we're doing the podcast, is, you know, to just, you know, feel creativity. And I feel like this is a movie that if you have any desire to write about film, if you have any desire to make film, or just even talk about film, like you're saying, Tyler, this is an essential movie. You know what I mean? This is a movie where you're getting essentially a 90-minute education that you might not even know you're getting,
mm-hmm.
But you are getting it. You know what I mean? And so if you see this and then you read on it about Tim Burton, about the movies that it's, you know, totally calling out, you're going to learn so much more than 90 minutes worth of information. So I just feel like for that alone, it's totally worth checking out. So
good call. Good call.
But the one thing is, it is in 4:3 on Netflix, aspect ratio, which is a little aggravating, but alas.
What was that last part? 4:3? What's that mean?
Like 4:3, like full screen instead of widescreen.
Yeah. Oh. It's like TV aspect ratio as opposed to 16:9 widescreen. But it's right. Fine. It's fine. It's okay.
I think it's a Stars play. Isn't that why?
Yeah. I think Stars usually
knocks it down. Yeah. It.
Yep.
And it's only available until the end of the month, too. So if you're going to watch it, folks, watch it soon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like today.
Speaking of quickly about Watch Instantly, did you read this thing? I don't know if this is, I just like quickly saw a headline or two and I read about it a little bit. There's a rumor or like an idea that they remove The Bodyguard, the Whitney Houston movie, from Netflix Watch Instantly so that more people would buy the DVDs.
Yep.
That's crazy.
That totally makes sense. I mean,
it makes sense, but it, like, just to think about, like, wow, that is shrewd business. That is like
someone had important. To think past the compassion of losing a human being to say, you know what? How can we make money off this?
Yep.
Get The Bodyguard off Instant Watch.
I mean,
that's supporting Gecko shit, man. That's
I'm not surprised by that at all. You know, like there's
Hollywood
is kind of a ruthless place when it comes to that kind of stuff. So,
although having said that, we still want a job at Netflix as the official podcast of the Red Ticket Company or whatever it's called.
Sure. Yeah. Why not?
So we love you for that decision.
Well, it actually didn't have anything to do with Netflix because somebody.
Yeah.
I read probably the same article that you did, Dan. I think it was on Gawker or something like that. But like the Netflix representative was like, the rights to stream this were pulled from the studio. So it was the studio. It was like a Warner Brothers decision. And I've never
Netflix
really been
still
clear.
A good company that we will work for.
I've never really been clear on how that whole thing works. I really need to look into it. Like how Netflix survives as a company on, do they work on like every 1,000 plays they get so much money, or like where does all that money go, and how do the studios profit from putting movies on Netflix Instant, because it seems like they're just kind of giving them away for $8 a month or whatever it is that we're paying. You know, there's a lot of, I'm sure like their licensing costs are out of this world.
I think the only way that they can exist is if they pay to have movies on there.
Yeah,
they have to make more from membership fees to balance that all out.
Yeah, I mean, I really need to look into that. So I don't know. Maybe if I
that would be an interesting story. I don't know if there's one out there, but that'd be.
Because what would the studios like? What would the studios have to gain for letting Netflix play their movies? I mean, word of mouth alone, I guess.
Yeah,
I mean,
because like otherwise you could just. They just wouldn't do it. So they have to be planning.
TV shows that are still on the air, sometimes Netflix on Instant will have like the first season if it's in its second season, but you can only watch. So, I mean, if you want to catch up, I mean, I can understand, studios or production companies or whatever allowing for the first couple seasons to be streamed so that they come on board to watch the rest of the show.
Yeah, then maybe they'll buy
time. But like movie companies that have movies that are like 20, 30 years old, like what do they have to gain? Can you buy DVDs from Netflix? Is that a thing?
No, I don't think so.
But what I love though is like you can totally see though the monetary thought behind it, because like there aren't a lot of Tom Cruise movies that are available on Instant. There aren't a lot of Christopher Nolan movies that are available on Instant. But you can pretty much watch any Robert Altman movie you want on Watch Instantly because you know his movies. You know, though most of them are very, very good. They're probably not making a lot of DVD money. So, and the rights are probably pretty low I love like doing that. Like, oh, let me search this director who made independent movies for 40 years. Oh, look at that. Half of his movies are available. I'm watching some.
Yeah.
After that Archer episode, I went to go instant queue all of the Burt Reynolds movies, and there were only a couple on there on instant watch. Everything else available by DVD. I was like, oh shit, I'm going to watch Gator now. And
did you watch,
I have to get it on DVD.
Dude, I got White Lightning and Gator. I got Gator and White Lightning right after I watched that episode of Archer, and they're both so bad, but they're so good.
I want to watch it. So good.
You need to watch it.
All right, well, Tyler, Tyler, pull the lever and tell people what we're going to be watching next week.
We have a comically large lever, Dan, that we pull, and it's connected to an Apple II computer, circa 1988. Actually,
nice.
It's all like binary. I mean, it's very, very, very basic. And on a ticker tape, it gives us our next movie. So why don't I pull that lever, guys?
All right, there you go.
All right, ticker tape's coming out. And, man, Dan, you must have tampered with my computer here because you mentioned The Shadow, and the computer, the Apple II, is choosing The Shadow, starring Alec Baldwin, of all people.
Two Alec Baldwin get movies in a row.
Get out of here.
Son of a Baldwin brother. I think Ray's dad from Everybody Loves Raymond is the cab driver in that. So
okay.
Take that as you will. Ian McKellen's in that, too. And who's the girl that in the shadow?
Bro,
Margot Penelope, Lane.
Dude, Penelope Ann Miller, bro. Come on.
Oh,
I think so. I got an IMDb check right now. Oh, no.
But I think her name's Margot Lane. I think that's the series character.
Margo. Oh, you mean the character's name. Oh, yeah.
Margot Lane is kind of like a Margot Kidder Lois Lane combo. That's weird.
I don't know. So I think I might get that. Oh, yeah. I think I might have that name wrong.
Yeah, dude, you're right. You're right. No, you're right. It's Lane? Penelope Ann Miller, the actress, played Margot Lane in The Shadow.
All right. There you go.
Four corners.
All right, well, you guys can subscribe to us in iTunes right now for our older episodes. We're going through some weird iTunes stuff.
From episode 74 and before, you can go to iTunes and download us.
Otherwise,
you have to go
there. Go to geektyrant.com and stream them there, or notjustinmovies.com, and you can find all the episodes there. We're going to figure this out sometime in the next week or so.
Yeah, just direct download from notjustmovies.com. That's how we've been doing it. That works for everybody.
And you can play it on your phone and all that kind of stuff, and iPods and everything.
Here soon.
Yeah, indeed. So you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. We're on twitter.com/njnmpodcast. And we do have two new followers this week, at Dave J. Hibbert and at Rhino215. So thanks for the follow,
guys. Yeah, I think we actually won Dave Hibbert over because Mr. Patches was talking to him, and I'm kind of a good eavesdropper on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Patches was talking to him, and he goes about Last of the Mohicans, and Mr. Patches was like, "Hey, I did an episode with the Not Just a Movies podcast about that," and I was like, "Hold up, playa, here's the link." And the guy got to listen to it and then followed us. So
nice.
Good salesman.
The internet.
And that's how you network, everybody.
Yeah,
that's
networking
attaches.
And we do have one email. You guys can feel free to email us anytime at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. The email's from Dark Aguirre, and it says, "I love this movie." You're talking about Beetlejuice. "I love this movie and do watch it at least once a year. I look forward to Ben and Tyler's thoughts. Michael Keaton was never better than when he was in this movie." And that's something that we didn't really talk about, surprisingly, is like Michael Keaton. But I think, you know, what is there to say about Michael Keaton and Beetlejuice other than he's kind of...
Well, he just goes for it, you know what I mean? He just totally goes for it in this movie. I mean, I don't know. Oh, you did not. No, you didn't. I don't know if he's multiplicity good, but he's pretty good.
I think he's Jack Frost good.
Oh.
Don't even say it. Watch your mouth with sarcasm.
Horror movie or the charming Christmas classic?
Both equally.
He's got a banana allergy.
All right, well, Tyler, let's finish up the character name game this week.
Wait, did we even mention that when we had Patches on for Hook that there was a lost boy named Patches?
You know what? I don't think we did. I don't know how.
What's the little boy that grabs his face and realizes he's Peter Pan? I think his name's Patches.
That's shocking that we didn't make that connection.
All right, we need to tell somebody that. Send it to the presses, Ben.
All right, yeah, I'll let Patches know.
And also, one more thing, since we've been talking so much about Alec Baldwin, I got to bring this up. Y'all talked about State of Grace last week, and so there's a movie that the same State of Grace director directed from like 96 or 95 called Heaven's Prisoners with Alec Baldwin. And if any of you all out there listening love watching terrible, bad, unbelievably like just messes of movies, you need to watch Heaven's Prisoners, directed by the State of Grace director with Alec Baldwin. It is so bad, and Alec Baldwin is so bad in it that you'll just wonder how he ever got into movies. So if you're really into that shit, like Heaven's Gate type of really bad movies, do it. It'll be worth your while. And that's it. That's all I have to say.
All right. Nice. So Tyler, let's wrap up the character name game.
Absolutely. I have a good one this week. Now, again, there's 2 degrees as opposed to the usual one. And the character's name for this week is Wade Garrett.
Wade Garrett.
Wade Garrett.
This sounds so familiar.
Think where this would lead you.
I mean, I'm thinking Deep South, obviously.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same.
I'm feeling a little swampy. I'm feeling a little
swampy. You might get warm as you approach that swamp, Dan.
It's not Sweet Home Alabama, because that would be 1 degree from Reese Witherspoon, who's in This Means War this
Absolutely.
Week.
Absolutely. We're going 2 degrees, baby.
So 2 degrees? I don't know, like Mississippi Burning or something?
That's a good guess.
No, that's incorrect.
Damn. Okay. Interesting. Okay.
It might be three. I don't know. Two to three.
God, Tyler. Well, you're gonna have to give us
3 degrees.
You're gonna have to give us some kind of hint then.
Okay. Wade Garrett was the character in this movie, and the movie was basically starring a young Patrick Swayze.
Oh, bro! Come on, you gave it away. I got it. I totally got it.
Do it.
Okay. Go ahead.
It's obviously Dirty Dancing Havana Nights. No, I'm kidding. It's freaking Roadhouse, bro.
Okay, now can Roadhouse? You name connections here?
Oh, the connections to.
Well, how can you connect that character to a movie that came out this weekend?
That's absurd.
Let him think it out. I think he's got it.
All right, I think I got it. Hold on. Give me a second.
Whoa.
I'm thinking it. All right, so what came out this week?
You got This Means War with Chris Pine, Tom Hardy, and Reese Witherspoon. And then you got Ghost Rider, Spirit of Vengeance.
Oh.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, you didn't. All right, so wait, hang on. So it's got to be... Okay, so...
We've actually mentioned his name in this episode.
Oh, I know what it is. All right, here you go.
All right, you do the connections.
Here
you
go. So
you got it.
Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance stars Nicolas Cage as the titular Ghost Rider, and he also starred in a movie called Ghost Rider back
Johnny
in
Blaze,
2007
correct.
With none other than Sam Elliott.
What? Oh, no, you didn't.
Who was also in Roadhouse, which is a really ridiculous character name game, Tyler, but I like it, so.
Wade, Sam Elliott. I was thinking... My mind immediately went to Days of Thunder when you said Wade Garrett, but then I stopped myself.
Yeah, that sounds like a John C. Reilly in Days of Thunder kind of character.
I literally thought it was that character. I was like, what was John C. Reilly in this week? Or like, who's been acting?
You're thinking of Ricky Bobby?
No, I'm thinking of, John C. Reilly.
Was John C. Reilly in Days of Thunder?
I'm pretty sure he was, because I think we did...
Thunder and Ricky Bobby.
Yeah, I think we did Tyler, like one of our first episodes was a double feature of Top Gun and Days of Thunder, and I'm pretty sure what's his name? Yeah, John C. Reilly plays Buck Bretherton in Days of Thunder.
Ricky Bobby's so bad.
And I have to say, we were talking about good bad guy names earlier. Yeah. Tom Cruise has the absolute best character name in the history of cinema in Days of Thunder, because his name is Cole Trickle. Trickle.
Yeah, I'm going to sign up on that script.
Amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
Written by the guy who wrote Chinatown. All right, keep going.
That is going to bring us to the end of this episode, so let's go around the circle and just tell people where they can find more of our work on the internet. Dan Meckel, let's start with you.
You can find me at thefilmstage.com and also on Twitter. The handle is DJMECCA.
Cool. Tyler, let's go to you.
You guys got a podcast over there at the Film Stage?
We had a podcast, and then we were like, podcasts? Well, we should start one again, but not right now, no.
All right. That's all good. So go over to the Film Stage and wait anxiously for a podcast that may come someday.
Exactly. That's the idea.
You can find me and my ramblings here on the podcast and probably on the Twitter, not just NJNM podcast Twitter feed. I like to interact with people. So if you have anything to say, positive or negative, shoot it my way. Again, that tag or the handle. I can't talk tonight. NJNM podcast. I will talk to you.
I've got a bunch of places that people can find me. You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BenPears. That's BenPears. You can find me doing a daily video roundup at geektyrant.com.
Those things are the shit, Ben.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I recently just started writing at firstshowing.net, so you can follow my work over there. I'm writing a lot more for filmonic.com now, and doing kind of collecting all my reviews at notjustinmovies.com, which is the namesake for this podcast. You can also hear me on the Geek Tyrant Weekly podcast, whenever we get around to doing those. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. So music for this episode will come courtesy of the Beetlejuice soundtrack. And a special thanks to Dan Mecca for donating some of your evening and hanging out with us, sir. Thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure, guys. Awesome hanging out.
Cool. All right. Well, you guys have a good one. We will be watching Alec Baldwin in The Shadow next week. So, And wait. Before we end, it looks like we got one new Twitter follower, and that is at DJ Mecca.
Oh, you know it, son. Oh, you know it. That's me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see y'all next week.
Thanks, Dan.
My girl later, guys. Is Sonora. I tell you, friends, I adore her. And when she dances, oh, brother, she's a hurricane in all kinds of weather. Jump in the line, rock your body and time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body and time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body and time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body and time. Shake, 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 Sonora, shake your body line. Whoop. Shake, 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 Sonora, shake it all the time. Work, 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 Sonora, work your body line. Work, 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 Sonora, work it all the time. You can talk about cha-cha, tango, waltz, or the rumba. Sonora's dance has no title. You jump in the saddle, hold on to the bridle. Jump in the line, rock your body and time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body. Rock your body, child. Jump in the line, rock your body and time. Somebody help me. Jump in the line, rock your body and time. Whoa.